welcome to The Truth About Fiction. I'm Lynn Michelle.
And I'm Derek Thompson.
And we're going to talk about the whole hard grinding business of being a writer, of writing and being published.
We're going to shatter some myths, break some hearts, and hopefully bring you something inspiring. But most of all, we will tell it how it is. So today I'm talking to Sue, who is a member of an international writers group, all three of us, and is also, more importantly, a self-published novelist. Hello, Sue.
Hi, Derek. Thank you for inviting me.
So, first, an obvious question. You have two published novels.
Yes.
What made you choose self-publication as a route?
I found that the frameworks that are published everywhere on the format of synopsis and these formulaic ways of attracting an agent and publishers to be quite stifling. And in the end, I decided, right, I'm just going to get on and write this thing. And I enjoyed every second of writing my first one and thought, right, now I need to get it out there. But getting it out there could take me 10 years through the agent and publisher route and luck and chance and all of that. And I thought, you know, while we're waiting 10 years, there's this amazing story that no one's reading. And I discovered that I could self-publish it just with a bit of computer savviness.
Yeah.
So I got on and did it and then learned how to use Twitter. And it did very well indeed. And I'm very glad I did it because I feel that now I can start publishing on pretty much any format. And here I am on podcast for the first time.
But how long did it take from finishing Chapel in the Woods, going tick, I like the edit, I'm happy with that, it's all formatted, to actually having it available for purchase?
I think it was about a month.
Really?
I'm a very fast typist. I'm quite experienced in formatting. And the instructions are really quite easy to publish online. I did pay somebody to do the final format edit so that you cut the clickable links to each chapter and all of that kind of thing. But I did my own jacket. Yeah, it was really quick. I wasn't working at the time.
Well, you were.
Yeah.
I always say I can type 60 words a minute as long as the word is A. I've used that line in almost every job interview I've ever been to. Not always to good effect. You mentioned the clickable links. You're talking about ebooks.
Yeah.
And is Chapel in the Woods out in paperback as well?
Yes, it is. Chapel in the Woods is available on Amazon in paperback now. First time round, it was on Feederread, who were excellent and brilliant. I switched to Amazon because I could get a smaller format of the book in the end. I think at the time, Amazon, you couldn't do it. So
I don't know if Feederread has gone the way of all mortal things now.
I think they're still going.
Oh, okay. Sorry, Feederread.
But they are excellent.
Yeah.
But you could get the matte covers now, which Feederread has still got the shiny ones, I think.
So. You mentioned Twitter, and I know you've been really good with Twitter because I picked your brain for my self-published novel, and I gave away 470 books. You know, people obviously download it, which is brilliant. And out of that, you assume you will get some sales, you will get some reviews. It's always been a difficult book anyway, but I think a book like yours, because it's got appeal in several.
I think you need a bigger volume of free downloads because that was what shot Chapel in the Woods to the top of the charts.
Yeah.
I waited till I had 1,000 Twitter followers.
Yeah.
And then I actually did a 2-day giveaway and I gave away 8,500 copies worldwide.
Yeah.
And it shot to the top of the free books chart. And then when it came back on sale, it shot to the top of the sold book charts as well. And it stayed in the top 10 of sort of genre charts for almost a year.
Would you call it, would you say that Chapel in the Woods is literary fiction? How would you describe it?
Yes, it's a historical mystery, if you want to put it into a smaller category.
Yeah.
It's actually very mainstream fiction. It's set in the 12th century, 1942, Second World War, and the modern day. And it's all about sort of linking time and places, that feeling that when you stand outside a very old building on some worn flagstones and you think, who stood here before me and why were they there and what were they worried about? And I think that that's quite a broad feeling that people get when they visit places, monuments, or even just walking down old streets. So for that, I think it is mainstream. And I imagined when I wrote it, because I'm a woman, that it would be female fiction. And that wasn't the case at all. It ended up being about 50-50. I was quite surprised.
I really enjoyed it. I was very impressed towards the end where it ties together. I mean, no spoilers, but it's in France. There's some French people. That's all I'll say. It's a bit like, so I can't cook to save my life. Is it a brioche where the things are folded over one another? Possibly not. What's the bread thing, you know, where they weave
croissant?
It? No, it's a bendy thing.
I don't know.
You know, where you get three strands. Like, yeah. Well, it's like
yes.
That. It comes together really well. It's not like you've suddenly gone at the end. Oh, and let's put this in.
That was carefully structured.
Yeah, no, you can see that it's well plotted. I mean, I always look at, because I'm a kind of genre writer, I suppose, I look at literary fiction where the themes are the driver, really. Belonging, loss, love, separation, whatever it is, drives the novel. And I always look at them with a kind of, not envy, but a sense of longing, because that's not how I write.
I think what drives my, I love structure.
Yeah.
And I like defying structure. So the structure of The Chapel in the Woods was inspired by something called The Hours by David something, and I can't remember his name. Where, like, when you're watching TV, you there's an opening scene. A chap is arriving in a car at an airport, yeah. And he gets out, takes out his suitcase, and walks into departures. And then it jumps to another woman, a woman at a kitchen table in New York, in front of a bunch of tulips, drinking a cup of tea. And she has a phone call, says something in it, and then it goes somewhere else to another strand. And when you've got these visual strands on TV, they're very fast, and the plots can build up very gradually.
Yeah.
And I wanted to create the same thing in a novel. So I've got this common place, this village, but when you're reading, perhaps you don't realise straight away it is the same place, but small signposts, and then three different characters in each of these eras and what they did there. And as the whole story is about why they're there, how the first story leads on to the second one, but they're actually being told concurrently so that the final scenario all sews up together in a fast-paced finale.
Yeah, it does come together really well. So, second book.
Yes.
Totally different.
Yes.
So how did that come about? How did you go from, I suppose, because I know we swapped emails about this beforehand. In a sense, it's a different genre. I don't know how you would define different genre. So tell us what your second book is.
So the second book, The Weather Gods,
yep.
Is in Cornwall, and it's about a very young, beautiful Cornish mosaic artist who controls the weather with her moods, but she doesn't realise. So this is magical realism.
Right.
It's almost believable, I hope. And this, I mean, it was inspired from living in Cornwall for 12 years and looking out the window and thinking, gosh, this weather's making me feel dreadful. And then I started imagining, what if my mood was making the weather? Fog in summer and horizontal rain and billowing wind that makes your house sound like a creaking ship. All of those factors, they really colour your day in yep. Cornwall. So there are all kinds of, you know, extreme phenomenon in weather. Like Boscastle was one, and I will never forget the day of the storm of Boscastle. I was lying on a very hot, sunny beach in West Cornwall, came home to switch on the news and hear, you know, what was going on over there. They were flooded up to, sort of, you know, 20 foot high or something. And in fact, one of my friend's houses was struck by lightning at the same time.
Wow.
So, and weather fascinates me because it's something that's beyond our control. So I thought it would be quite fun to imagine that you could control it. But I think the challenge of structure with The Weather Gods, because it is linear, it goes from start to finish,
yeah.
Was that there are several layers to it. So you can read it for the, you know, feel good Cornish factor, the atmospheric landscape, people, you know, and it's a very, very lovely place to be. And then there's this magical element that's linked in with sort of simulation of Norse gods. There's some sort of Cornish gods. It's all a bit of a mishmash that I kind of made up. You can link this in, but it's also about nurturing and looking after people and caring about people. So it's very different to the Chapel in the Woods, but the common theme across both of them is a small community. I'm fascinated by people and how they interact, how their jealousies, their fears, the way they care for each other too, and how they interact in these small groups. The Chapel in the Woods is set in a small village in the Loir-et-Cher, which is a département of northwestern France. And The Weather Gods is set in a small fishing village called Porthtarran, which some may notice is an exact mix of Porthsands and Porthleven. Because if you're going to write something, you must write it ideally.
How much of you is in the books? Oh, if we get cut off, we'll go for part two. This bit won't be in there, but I might leave it in anyway because it's funny and it shows my technical incompetence. How much of you is in the books, do you think, or your own experience?
I think an awful lot is in them. I think my values are in them. My interest in things is in them. I particularly enjoyed writing The Chapel in the Woods because it did need so much research. So although there are events and characters and historical facts in it that, you know, I had to look up, I had to find them out to get them just right. It was, yeah, it's about what I'm interested in. So ultimately, I write to please myself, but with the opportunity of sharing it with others for them to enjoy, it just makes it golden. And The Weather Gods, I think there was more of me in The Weather Gods than probably The Chapel in the Woods, partly because I was probably a bit more confident second time round. What holds people back is fear of judgment and evaluation when they're writing, when they're new writing.
Several times people have said to me in my books, is that you? And actually none of them are me. Some of the situations, not the spying, but...
I don't think the characters are me. Some of them are who I'd like to be. Yeah. Some of them are who I'd hate to be.
That's interesting.
But ultimately, there's elements. I mean, everything you write, it necessarily has to have you in it. You can't.
Do your characters sort of arrive organically? Or do you, almost like a film script, I imagine, do you develop a character because you need a hole to fill in the plot or the story, or there needs to be a protagonist or an antagonist?
Sometimes. So sometimes, like The Weather Gods, I wanted to start it in it. You know, one of the reasons, not The Weather Gods, sorry, The Chapel in the Woods was inspired by Thomas Becket and his escape to France when he heard that Henry II was going to do him in. And I thought, well, if I write it about Thomas Becket, then I've got to be really an expert historian. And actually, I wanted more literary freedom, creative freedom. So I decided to write it about, because then I went to Canterbury and had a look where Thomas Becket was and what was there. And there was a priory in Canterbury, and there where they would take in young monks who were either their parents couldn't afford to feed them, they would take them in, young children, and bring them up as monks. I decided to do it that way. And now I can't remember what the question was.
It was where characters come from, I think.
I wanted a trainee monk, and then I read a whole load about attitudes and philosophies of medicine, and I'm very keen on herbal medicine. Not that I use it particularly, but it just fascinates me, a bit like the weather. I created this character, and then I gave him a voice, talking in the way that people talked, or I would imagine that they would talk back then, and that's how that evolved. I mean, he's 17. In the novel. So then I was, you know, imagined him with as a 17-year-old English boy and how different he would have been. So that was, you know, very contrived, that one. And yet I think the place, the environment develops who people are. Sometimes they're elements of people I know.
Yeah.
And if I get really stuck for a character, I have a whole pile of cast-off colour supplements from the Sunday paper. Because I'm the trashy person in the household and I get to look at the pictures. Well, other people read the more serious content. And I use those a lot as a result. So I'll open them up and I'll look at pictures and I'll read some articles and I will cut out pictures. And I think my character looks like this. And then I will start writing them that way.
I did that with Thomas Bladen. I saw a picture, which I've still got somewhere, in a magazine. And I thought, that's what he looks like. And eventually I found someone who looked like Miranda. And when I sent them to the publisher, subsequently, he said, that's nowhere near how I picture them, which is sort of interesting. I mean...
Well, I think, but your writing is very different. It's a different genre to mine. So yours, I do a lot of description, so you can really see what's going on.
I don't, but a lot some do in the genres.
Well, that's my point. So I think that's probably why, because yours is very fast paced action. There's a lot of sort of cerebral stuff, but he's thinking about it himself.
So your second book, obviously, naturally, you went the self-published route.
Yeah.
Was your experience different? I mean, obviously, you were more confident, you knew what you were doing, but was the experience any different?
Yes, it was, because what I learned the most is that if you're self-publishing, you have to make sure you've got the backup of marketing time.
Yeah.
You need to market your books, because it's great. You write a book and you think, yeah, you know, I'm proud of that. I've had some excellent reviews from it and people telling me that it should be a screenplay, and people who know Cornwall who really loved it. But without, you know, at least an hour a day on social media to tell people it's there, people just aren't going to buy it. And I wasn't able at the time to invest that time in it. So that is the key, that, you know, you go to a publishing house who will hopefully promote your books for you.
Yes. So why Twitter particularly, as opposed to Facebook or any of the others?
Facebook, I see as more of a more intimate social media setting. I mean, I have two separate ones. I have a private one and then I have a public one. Some people use them for both, but I have, you know, a lot of my personal friends on there. And it just feels like I don't like living life too publicly. So Twitter, you know, it's great for sort of quick banter and humour, and you can put links on it, and you can reach people you don't know. I think that's the main thing.
Well, maybe it doesn't work this way for you, but once a book has been published and you're obviously promoting it before you start another book, or is it just that you get an inspiration? This is part two. I should say no one will know this, but we know. We just spoke for about 15 minutes and really excellent stuff, which I forgot to record. The last bit in part one, we were talking about books overlapping, and I'll summarise because I want to kind of pick up where we just were, and about how you write what you write, you find inspiration where you find inspiration, and the most important thing is to keep going and to not hold back. Have you had personal experience as an author where you either wanted to put something in and didn't, or you resisted, and when you put it in, you found that actually it transformed the book or helped you as an author?
That's a really tough question, because I have to remember. I think as a person, I'm not somebody who tends to hold back anyway. So I do tend to write without fear. When I go back and edit, you know, I think the only thing I would say is, you know, those trumpeting moments when you write this fabulous paragraph here with bells and whistles and you think, wow, this is the opening to Bleak House standard. And you know, you can feel the glory and the bells of Canterbury Cathedral going in your head as you're putting on that full stop. And then you go back and you read it and it's just self-indulgent dross and you just have to delete the whole thing. That happens quite a lot. I don't think I do hold back. When I write my first drafts, and then one of the techniques I use is when I've got that final draft and I'm going to make, you know, do the proofreading at that stage, I will read it out loud from start to finish. So I'll print it off and I will pace up around the house, the garden, wherever it is I am, and I will read it out. And if there's a clunky sentence or it doesn't sound good or it doesn't sound fitting to the sentence, then I edit heavily. And for me, I want the content to come out rhythmically in time with the narrative.
So a particular literary fiction structure, or do you think that's true of any writing?
What is a typical literary fiction structure?
Well, I don't know, because I don't write literary fiction. I mean, I have a friend, trying to think where he is now, he was in the States, now in mainland Europe, Thornton Sally Thorne, who runs Word Will You Press, which is an online community and a US-based publisher that I've sort of very loosely involved with now. I've kind of edged myself to the periphery. But his view of what is literary fiction, he says when it's about more than the story, there's something else going on.
Yes. So, yes, no, I, there isn't a sort of set structure, but yeah, you've got themes and you've got underlying layers, and that's what I like to write in. I like to give people a book that they can pick up and read for face value, entertainment, but they can think about it a bit more if they want to. They can think about the writer's motivations. They can link themes from, I know, a character to a landscape, to the weather, to, feelings of loss, death, destruction, whatever it is that's featuring. So I think my point was that those things, that is the definition of a literary fiction. But in terms of structure, what's marvellous about it is that you can do anything you like, as long as it makes sense. If people can follow it, they can understand it, and they can pick up on it, then your structure can actually be a whole character in the book. And that's what I love the most. I mean, I started work on a new novel, and the structure that I'm attempting is that the whole book is going to have been told in somebody's head in about an hour.
Okay, so that's condensed.
It's going to be, when you think of how the human mind works, and you can sit having your boiled egg in the morning and you can think about, you know, what you're doing now, your boiled egg, your teaspoon, your plate in front of you, your salt and pepper. You can think about the shopping list that you're about to write. But equally, in that same time, you might think about a loved one that you lost 30 years ago. You might think of the house that you lived in back then. And all of these, you know, and then you might think of the jumper you saw them wearing last time before they passed away. And all of these thoughts can fly through your brain in such a short space of time. And I think it's, my battery's going, sorry.
That's been said about me for years, creatively.
And there's a few people who've done things like this, like Saint-Exupéry, no, who was it? Vol de Nuit. Is that Voltaire? No, it's not. I'll have to look it up. But Vol de Nuit is written about by, I think it was Saint-Exupéry actually, when he was a pilot. And he liked to, this book is about what happened, you know, he's got this story front to back, but actually he's written it down as he remembered it, which is in different parts, and it's all chops and changes, and that, you know, and it's very difficult to follow. But you know, he did incredibly well with it. I think it was called Courrier Sud, actually, not Vol de Nuit. And it's about that. It's about writing as things appear to us. Franz Kafka's Metamorphosis. I mean, that was a linear story, but absolutely off the wall and brilliant.
Rentokil, quite interested in. So it's interesting you said the other book, that it was difficult to follow, but it still did well.
I was 18 at the time, and I was reading it in the original French, but so that might have been a factor, but I did find it difficult to follow.
Are you considering audiobooks, which is the other big thing?
Yes, I am. I recorded with a bunch of brilliant amateur dramatic people last year, parts to a radio play that I wrote that I'm still yet to cobble together, and I realised just how easy it is to record something. And I have a couple of excellent microphones. So that's something I want to do too. I have so many things on my list. I'm going to have to fit it all in. But I think audio is good.
Yeah, they seem to be another strong product line, essentially. And there are other companies coming out as well alongside the big boys. There are another couple of smaller companies that have come out recently as independents that offer. I don't know if the percentages are similar. Obviously, the reach is different because they're building their audience as well.
Well, I mean, this is a classic tailoring it to the modern world, because if you walk down the street and say good morning to people, often they don't answer because they can't hear you.
I'd like to think that's why. But yeah, everyone has got,
you know, they've got headphones on, you know, and it's not just the young generation, it's everybody. They're on the bus, they've got headphones on, they're walking the dog, they've got headphones, they're cycling, they've got headphones on. And some people listen to music, some listen to the radio, but some are listening to audiobooks. Because this is, I'm renovating a house, and I will stick on audiobooks and headphones while I'm sanding, plastering, painting, because they're menial, long, therapeutic jobs. And you can lose yourself at the same time.
It's incomprehensible to me that anyone would cycle and have headphones on.
Terrifying.
Sounds like the ultimate in stupidity. Talk about not understanding the concept. I mean,
well, I live in Oxford. Some people, I phone them up, and they'll answer, and I'll be a bit of background noise, and I feel sorry. Are you a bit busy? Well, I'm just cycling back from work. So they've got their entire office operational on their push bike.
We should say that safe cycling techniques are also available. Right, I'm going to leave you to get on with whatever you're doing. And I will see you on the next International Writers Group. Thanks very much for your time and for the bit we didn't record, or I didn't record. Whatever. This is part two. I should say no one will know this, but we know. We just spoke for about 15 minutes and really excellent stuff, which I forgot to record. The last bit in part one, we were talking about books overlapping, and I'll summarize because I want to kind of pick up where we just were, and about how you write what you write. You find inspiration where you find inspiration. And the most important thing is to keep going and to not hold back. Have you had personal experience as an author where you either wanted to put something in and didn't, or you resisted, and when you put it in, you found that actually it transformed the book or helped you as an author?
That's a really tough question because I have to remember. I think as a person, I'm not somebody who tends to hold back anyway. Okay. So I do tend to write without fear. When I go back and edit, I think the only thing I would say is, those trumpeting moments when you write this fabulous paragraph here with bells and whistles and you think, wow, this is the opening to Bleak House standard. Yeah. You can feel the glory and the bells of Canterbury Cathedral going in your head as you're putting on that full stop. And then you go back and you read it and it's just self-indulgent dross and you just have to delete the whole thing. That happens quite a lot. I don't think I do hold back. I write my first drafts, and then one of the techniques I use is when I've got the final draft and I'm going to make do the proofreading at that stage, I will read it out loud from start to finish. So I'll print it off and I will pace up around the house, the garden, wherever it is I am, and I will read it out. And if there's a clunky sentence or it doesn't sound good or it doesn't sound fitting to the sentence, then I edit heavily. And for me, I want the content to come out rhythmically in time with the narrative.
Do you think that's a particular literary fiction structure, or do you think that's true of any writing? You know,
what is a typical literary fiction structure?
Well, I don't know, because I don't write literary fiction. I mean, I have a friend, trying to think where he is now. He was in the States, now in mainland Europe. Thornton Sally Thorne, who runs Word Will You Press, which is an online community and a US-based publisher that I'm sort of very loosely involved with now. I've kind of edged myself to the periphery. But his view of what is literary fiction, he says when it's about more than the story, there's something else going on.
Yes. So, yes, no, there isn't a sort of set structure, but yeah, you've got themes and you've got underlying layers, and that's what I like to write in. I like to give people a book that they can pick up and read for face value, entertainment, but they can think about it a bit more if they want to. They can think about the writer's motivations. They can link themes from, I know, a character to a landscape, to the weather, to feelings of loss, death, destruction, whatever it is that's featuring. So I think my point was that those things, that is the definition of a literary fiction. But in terms of structure, what's marvelous about it is that you can do anything you like, as long as it makes sense. If people can follow it, they can understand it, and they can pick up on it, then your structure can actually be a whole character in the book. And that's what I love the most. I mean, I started work on a new novel, and the structure that I'm attempting is that the whole book is going to have been told in somebody's head in about an hour.
Right. Okay, so that's condensed.
It's going to be, when you think of how the human mind works, and you can sit having your boiled egg in the morning and you can think about, you know, what you're doing now, your boiled egg, your teaspoon, your plate in front of you, your salt and pepper. You can think about the shopping list that you're about to write. But equally, in that same time, you might think about a loved one that you lost 30 years ago. You might think of the house that you lived in back then. And all of these, you know, and then you might think of the jumper you saw them wearing last time before they passed away. And all of these thoughts can fly through your brain in such a short space of time. And I think it's, are you still there? My battery's going, sorry.
Oh, I'm still here. That's been said about me for years, creatively.
And there's a few people that have done things like this, like Saint-Exupéry, no, who was it? Vol de Nuit. Is that Voltaire? No, it's not. I'll have to look it up. But Vol de Nuit is written about by, I think it was Saint-Exupéry, actually, when he was a pilot. And he liked to, this book is about what happened. You know, he's got this story front to back, but actually he's written it down as he remembered it, which is in different parts, and it's all chops and changes, and that, you know, and it's very difficult to follow. But you know, he did incredibly well with it. I think it was called Courrier Sud, actually, not Vol de Nuit. And it's about that. It's about writing as things appear to us.
It's interesting.
Like Franz Kafka's Metamorphosis. I mean, that was a linear story, but absolutely off the wall and brilliant.
Yeah, Rentokil, quite interested in. You can add the handbook and then you can whack things. It's interesting you said the other book, that it was difficult to follow, but it still did well.
I was 18 at the time and I was reading it in the original French, but so that might have been a factor. But I did find it difficult to follow.
Are you considering audiobooks, which is the other big thing?
Yes, yes, I am. I recorded with a bunch of brilliant amateur dramatic people last year, parts to a radio play that I wrote that I'm still yet to cobble together. And I realised just how easy it is to record something. And I have a couple of excellent microphones. So that's something I want to do too. I have so many things on my list. I'm going to have to fit it all in. But I think audio is good.
Yeah, they seem to be another strong product line, essentially. And there are other companies coming out as well, alongside the big boys. There are another couple of smaller companies that have come out recently as independents that offer, I don't know if the percentages are similar. Obviously, the reach is different because they're building their audience as well.
Well, I mean, this is a classic, tailoring it to the modern world, because if you walk down the street and you say good morning to people, often they don't answer because they can't hear you.
I'd like to think that's why. But yeah, everyone has got...
Yeah, they've got headphones on. You know, and it's not just the young generation, it's everybody. They're on the bus, they've got headphones on, they're walking the dog, they've got headphones, they're cycling, they've got headphones on. And some people listen to music, some listen to radio, but some are listening to audiobooks. Because this is, I'm renovating a house and I will stick on audiobooks and headphones while I'm sanding, plastering, painting, because they're menial, long, therapeutic jobs. And you can lose yourself at the same time.
It's incomprehensible to me that anyone would cycle and have headphones on.
Terrifying.
Sounds like the ultimate in stupidity. Talk about not understanding the concept. I mean,
I live in Oxford, and some people I phone them up, and they'll answer, and there'll be a bit of background noise, and I feel sorry. Are you a bit busy? Oh, I'm just cycling back from work. So they've got their entire office operational on their push bike.
It's just crazy.
Crazy world that we live in.
We should say that safe cycling techniques are also available. Right, I'm going to leave you to get on with whatever you're doing, and I will see you on the next International Writers Group. Thanks very much for your time and for the bit we didn't record.